There's a famous formulation in the law known as Blackstone's formulation. It comes from 18th century English jurist William Blackstone, who wrote that it is better that 10 guilty persons escape than that one innocent suffer. The question is whether we've created a criminal justice system that gives life to Blackstone's formulation. According to Brian Stevenson of the Equal Justice Initiative, the answer is no.
I mean, it's fascinating. Death penalty in America is defined by error. For every 9 people who have been executed, we've actually identified one innocent person who's been exonerated and released from death row. A kind of astonishing error rate. 1 out of 9 people, innocent. I mean, it's fascinating in aviation. We would never let people fly on airplanes if for every 9 planes that took off, one would crash. But somehow we can insulate ourselves from this problem. It's not our problem. It's not our burden. It's not our struggle.
Out of all the evidentiary doctrines that we have, there's one that stands out as being diametrically opposed to Blackstone's formulation, and you can get a pretty good sense of it from a comment by Bruce Willis's John McClane in the movie Die Hard 2.
Oh man, I can't fucking believe this. Another basement, another elevator. How could the same shit happen to the same guy twice?
How can the same thing happen to the same guy twice? That's the gist of the doctrine of chances, in which jurors are asked whether bad luck is actually bad faith. It's the evidentiary doctrine at the heart of a trial that took place in North Carolina in 2001, but with 2 key differences. First, jurors were asked, how can the same thing happen to the same woman twice? And second, it wasn't really the same thing at all.
Hi, and welcome to Undisclosed, the State versus Pamela Lanier. This is the first in the series of 4 episodes about the case of Pam Lanier, who was convicted of the 1997 murder of her husband, Doran, in Chincapin, North Carolina. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of A Non-Story. I'm here with my colleagues, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, I'm Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at theviewfromll2.com.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
Chincapin is a small farming community adjacent to the Northeast Cape Fear River in Duplin County, North Carolina. Many of its residents have the last names Lanier and Hatcher, including several people involved in this case. On November 19, 1997, Doran Lanier, a turkey farmer, had a seizure. The husband and wife EMT team of Harold and Pam Hatcher arrived and took Doran to the hospital at 6:25 p.m. At 10:57 p.m. that night, Doran was pronounced dead. Before he died, Doran told several witnesses, including Pam Hatcher, the same thing.
And I said, make sure you tell the doctor. He says, well, I've got a sore on my hip. And he started to show it to me. I was like, no, just show the doctor. Tell the doctor, you know, everything Pam's been telling me. Then she came back in, and he said, if it wasn't for her, I would not be here tonight. You know, he said, I did this to myself, but I'm going to get better.
In the first week of September 1997, Doran had been injured in a bulldozer accident, and his wife Pam had been his primary caretaker for the last 2.5 months of his life. Doran's deathbed statement seems to reflect 3 things. 1, he wouldn't have made it this far without his wife. 2, he had been self-medicating. And 3, through that self-medicating, he had done this to himself. On the day of his death, Doran's skin was yellow. The day after Doran died, Dr. Charles Garrett performed an autopsy on him and determined that his body was yellow on the inside as well. The cause of death, chronic and acute arsenic poisoning. For authorities, this set off alarm bells because there were 2 infamous cases of women killing men through arsenic poisoning in recent North Carolina history.
In 1978, Roland Stewart Turner died, and elevated levels of arsenic were found in his system. Suspicion soon fell on his caretaker, Velma Barfield. Later, the case was covered on CNN's Death Row Stories, and here's an excerpt from that episode.
A curious prosecutor began investigating. He decided to check the death certificates of all the people who had died in Velma's care. He found a pattern.
It was like a suit of cards. Acute gastroenteritis. Acute gastroenteritis, acute gastroenteritis, gastroenteritis, and gastroenteritis.
So they exhumed the body of Velma's deceased husband, Jennings Barfield. Testing then revealed elevated levels of arsenic. Velma was convicted of murdering Roland Turner, and later she became the first North Carolinian executed since the death penalty had been reinstated in the Tar Heel State back in 1977. About a decade after that, the Reverend Dwight Moore became violently ill one day after eating a fast food fried chicken sandwich, which was given to him by his wife, Blanche Taylor Moore. After going to the hospital, it was determined that he had received 20 times the lethal dose of arsenic in his system, which was the highest the hospital had ever seen. Blanche had previously dated a man named Raymond Reed, who had also died under odd and suspicious circumstances. Here's a clip from another show, this time Deadly Women, talking about the Blanche Taylor Moore case.
Blanche would be charged with assault, and police probed further, exhuming the body of Raymond Reed. The chief medical examiner in North Carolina, John Butts, M.D., exposed one of the state's most audacious murders.
This is graphing of the quantities of arsenic that were found in Mr. Reed's hair, and this tells us that that initial illness was a result of arsenic poisoning, but also tells us that he continued to receive arsenic while he was in the hospital.
So after the determination was made that Dorian Lanier had died from arsenic poisoning, Dr. Butts was called in to consult on the case. It turned out that Pam had a prior husband who had also died under circumstances that might be qualified as suspicious. In 1989, Pam had married Johnny Ray Williams, and the two had lived in Surf City, a beach community over on Topsail Island, which is a 26-mile barrier island in southeastern North Carolina. Topsail is a narrow island with the Atlantic Ocean on one side on the east and the intracoastal waterway on the other side to the west. And Pam and Johnny Ray had a trailer on the western canal side, with a dock jutting into the intracoastal waterway in their backyard. And from all appearances, Pam and Johnny Ray had a loving relationship. Wake Forest law student Natalie Wilson talked to Pam's niece, April Everett, and here's what she had to say about the relationship between Pam and Johnny Ray.
They always seemed happy. I mean, he drank a lot. I do remember that. Like 7 and 7 or something like that.
Yeah.
I always remember that. But I don't remember... I mean, they seemed happy too. Those were the two, I believe Pam loved them both. I think she was completely in love with Johnny. And then when Doran came along, she loved him. And I think she grew to love him as much, or if not more, than Johnny. But, you know, at first, I didn't think she was ever going to get over Johnny.
Really?
Yeah.
And here's Pam's own description of her relationship with Johnny Ray.
Me and Johnny got along great. If I ever had a soulmate in my life, it was Johnny.
Mm-hmm. And what makes you say that? What?
Because I loved him so unconditionally. He was perfect. Not, well, I kind of call him perfect. Quit laughing. He was perfect. No matter if he had drinks or not drinks, he was the same person all the time. Mm-hmm. And if I wanted to do something, and he had this thing, if she wants to go out, we go out together, or if I want to go out, we go out together. She don't care what I do, or I don't care what she does, but if we're going out to a place that people might talk, we go as a couple, so they won't talk. I mean, he just kind of covered all the tracks, you know, and made sure, and we just had an easy laid-back going relationship.
Blue Apron is the leading meal kit delivery service in the U.S., and while many people know what they do, many don't know about the types of meals you eat when you cook with Blue Apron. For example, as a pescatarian, I'm really looking forward to two of their upcoming meals in May, the Southern Spiced Cod and Tartar Sauce with buttermilk mashed potatoes and sweet pepper slaw, and the Lemon Ginger Salmon over carrots, spring peas, and orzo. Blue Apron offers two things that are huge to me, ease and flexibility. In terms of ease, they deliver fresh, pre-portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes right to my door, making it easy to cook them after a long day of work. And in terms of flexibility, Blue Apron offers three plans. A two-person meal plan where you can choose from 8 new recipes per week with a choice to receive either 2 or 3 recipes any week. A family plan that serves 4 people where you choose from 4 new recipes per week with a choice to receive their 2, 3, or 4 recipes any week. And a wine plan where you get 6 bottles of wine from renowned winemakers delivered monthly. and there's never been a better time to try Blue Apron. For 6 weeks, from April 16th through May 21st, Blue Apron is teaming with Airbnb to bring you the best home cooking from around the world. Each week, the menu will feature a recipe developed in collaboration with an Airbnb Experiences host like Cece, a chef from Shanghai who makes incredible Kung Pao chicken, a beloved sticky sauce mix of crispy brown chicken and vegetables. So check out this week's menu and get your first 3 meals free at blueapron.com/undisclosed. That's blueapron.com/undisclosed. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. On August 20th, 1991, Johnny Ray was admitted to the hospital. According to his medical records, quote, "On exam, he is confused and or aphasic. I tend to think the latter. He finally got his name. He first gave his age correctly as 37, changed it to 36. He couldn't get the date of birth." Dr. David Bachman diagnosed Johnny Ray with febrile illness, or a fever of an uncertain cause. Johnny Ray was treated and discharged. He had a follow-up visit 2 weeks later on September 4th, 1991 at 2:20 p.m. According to Dr. Bachman, quote, "Johnny Ray is seen emergently because his BPs, or blood pressures, are sky high. He has no further confusion. He has cut his smoking in half down to one half pack per day. He has a lot of shakiness and tremors, probably due to cutting down on the alcohol and cigarettes." Johnny Ray was discharged later that day with a prescription for Tenormin for his blood pressure and Ativan for his shakiness. According to Pam, throughout the day, Johnny Ray took Tenormin for his blood pressure and 5 Ativan pills and some Benadryl for his shakiness. She also said that he drank about a third of a 1.75-liter bottle of Seagram's. Their 8-year-old son, Dustin, says that around midnight, Johnny Ray said he was going to check the crab pots off the dock. Pam responded by telling him that he didn't need to go out, and Johnny Ray replied, quote, "I'm going out to check them anyhow." Johnny Ray then walked out in the dock with a glass of liquor in his hand. According to Dustin, Pam opened the back door and yelled at Johnny Ray to come back in. Johnny Ray turned around at hearing Pam's voice and then turned back around again, tripping and falling into the water. Here's Pam's current recollection of Johnny Ray falling into the water.
Is he out of sorts at all? Does he seem normal?
Him and Dustin went out to check the crab pots, and I asked him not to go out.
Right, so he says around midnight, I'm going to go check the crab pots.
Yes, he puts the crab pots.
And what reason did you tell him not to go out then?
Because he had already been drinking, it was late, and Dustin was up, and he was wanting to go with him, and I didn't want Dustin out there with him.
Mm-hmm. And so he starts walking out to check the crab pots, and then what happens next?
I was coming out the door, and he was down at the end of the dock, where the dock is, and he started wavering a little bit, and Dustin hollered at me, "Mama, Daddy's gonna fall," and he did fall, and I come running out there to him, and when I got out there, we had a like a crab pot net. He was fighting a little bit, and Johnny could swim. And I put that out there for him, and he couldn't grab it. And then he went down under. I said, "Come here, Dustin." I grabbed him because I couldn't see him. I grabbed him, and I run down the street to Thompson's house, I think it's Rudy Thompson. And I got him, and he come back up there with me.
Pam and Johnny Ray didn't have a phone in their trailer, so as she noted, Dustin and she ran over to the house belonging to their neighbor, Rudy Thompson, to call 911 and to try to get some help. I talked to Thompson about his recollection of the night of September 4th.
What I do remember, of course, is going down there that night. I want to say her son or somebody came up to the house and got us, and I went right down there right away as soon as they either called or came up. I don't remember how, who came up and got me, but I went down there. I was the first one on the scene, and I was told he was right beside the pier. Right beside the dock that went out into the water. And whenever I got there, I didn't see any bubbles. I didn't see any person. I didn't see anybody in the water at all. And, I looked and looked and stayed. And I think somebody came up with some headlights or something shining on the water and trying to see if he was out there anywhere, because that's what she was hollering about. He had fell in off the dock. He had been drinking and everything else, and had a crab pot or something out there, and he fell in.
Finally, after the Surf City police arrived, Johnny Ray's body surfaced.
It might have been an hour that was down there, and finally we saw a white T-shirt floating about midway of the war, of the canal. I helped pull him to shore.
The police report by Officer M.C. Scholes in the drowning suggests a more compressed timeline. It notes that a 911 call was received at about 12.08 a.m. and that Rudy Thompson retrieved Johnny Ray's body from the Intracoastal Waterway at about 12.30 a.m. I asked Thompson about whether Pam was acting the way you might expect given the circumstances.
I want to say, yeah, I mean, she was upset, you know, she was hollering, somebody's got to help me, you know, stuff like that, best I can remember. You know, it's been years.
Right.
The Surf City Police Department seemed to agree. There were no signs of bruises or cuts on Johnny Ray's body and no other signs of foul play. And so, in 1991, Johnny Ray's death was officially determined to be accidental. But now, after Doran's death in 1998, and with Dr. Butts on board, the decision was made to exhume Johnny Ray's body to determine whether he had elevated arsenic levels in his system. According to Pam herself, the state was trying to prove that she fit the archetype, or really the stereotype, of the Black Widow, who marries men and then murders them for their money. The state probably didn't need Pam's consent to exhume Johnny Ray's body, but she gave it to them anyway.
And then what's going through your head when you learn that they're going to exhume Johnny Ray's body?
I signed for him to do it. Mm-hmm. I told them, when they told me that they wanted to do it, and Doug says they're talking about it, he said, now we can do it this way. We can either get you to sign for it, or they're going to probably down the road force it. If you know, it would be better if I picked up the phone and called and said, listen, she's okay with this. She signed the papers, and I signed the papers.
Right.
Johnny Ray's body was exhumed on January 23rd, 1998. By this point, the case had garnered a good deal of attention, and the exhumation was aired on the news.
We watched it on television. It was awful. Matter of fact, there was a clipping about it on television.
The exhumation?
Yes, where they dug him up. Mr. Brown, the sheriff, had donuts and coffee out there. All that was on the news. It was a big blow up on the news about it. And they had it all on the news. And he told me, if there's one thing that they can catch you on, he said, they're going to be back to lock you up tomorrow. He said, I'll be honest. He said, because they're trying so hard. The place was crawling with people out there at the graveyard. You would not believe how it looked.
Dr. Butts performed an autopsy on Doran's body and issued his report on March 9th. According to the report, quote, a toxicological examination of tissues obtained in autopsy were negative for heavy metals by a Reinsch screen and demonstrated insignificant levels of arsenic by more specific quantitative analysis. This would rule out arsenic as a cause of his death and as an explanation for his previous episode of mental confusion. In the district attorney's press release 2 weeks later, he would note that, quote, at the autopsy, no obvious sign of injury was identified. Toxicological examinations of tissue were conducted and no significant levels of arsenic were detected. Arsenic was ruled out as a cause of death. The autopsy did not disclose any additional findings that would contradict the previous ruling of accidental drowning as the cause of death. At this point, you might be wondering why we're even mentioning the drowning of Johnny Ray, because surely it could have played no role in the prosecution of Pam for poisoning Doran. After all, Johnny Ray's death was deemed accidental. Well, it turns out the death of Johnny Ray was the centerpiece of the state's case against Pam Lanier. Once again, here's Pam Hatcher, the EMT called to the Lanier house on the night of Dorian's death.
If you've read the transcript, if you're familiar with it, and if you wanted to sit down and count the times Johnny was mentioned and the times Dorn was mentioned, you'll see it's like triple Johnny, Dorn nothing.
When I spoke to Pam Lanier's mother, Shirley, she expressed a similar sentiment.
We did not have to trial on Dorn. We had it on Johnny Ray.
Right. That's what a lot of people say, yeah.
We never had a trial on Dorn. Never did we have a trial on Dorn.
And Pam herself says the same thing.
The whole trial was on Johnny. It wasn't on Dorn. Mm-hmm. It wasn't on Dorn at all.
Right.
I mean, they didn't use... matter of fact, Doug told me up to the point when they brought Johnny up, he told me straight up, he said, when we go to court, he said, if they had not have brought Johnny Williams up, he said, I wouldn't even worry about this. He said, but now that they're trying to throw Johnny in it, he said, they're going to make it look like you had two husbands to die the same way. He said, even though we know, but he said, that's not the way they're going to do it.
So yes, Pam had two husbands who had died under strange circumstances, but they were very different in nature. So how is it that the drowning of Johnny Ray would come to play not just a role, but the starring role at Pam's trial for murder for her second husband, Dorian? In this case, the reasons trace all the way back to 1915. In January of that year, British Detective Inspector Arthur Neal received a letter with two newspaper clippings concerning the drowning deaths of Margaret Elizabeth Lloyd and Alice Smith in bathtubs. Later, it was learned that Bessie Mundy had also drowned in a bathtub, and there was something that linked all three women. They had been married to George Joseph Smith. Forensic pathologist Bernard Spilsbury was assigned to the case, and you might imagine his first order of business. Here's a clip from a Forensic Casebook episode on the case.
Spilsbury ordered the exhumation of all three bodies, but after thorough autopsies, he was no closer to finding a cause of death. As far as he was concerned, the women were perfectly healthy when they got in the bath. There was nothing to suggest they'd been drowned by force. Spilsbury went back to his books. How could Smith have done it?
Finding no evidence of foul play, though, Spilsbury and D.I. Neal nonetheless pushed forward. Here's a clip from the TV show One Moment in Crime.
Both Spilsbury and D.I. Neal were determined to prove that Smith killed his wives. The pair reenacted each bathtub scene using women who were physically similar to each wife. Using the very tubs the brides had died in, they discovered that if the women were grabbed by the legs and pulled forward, then the women's heads immediately became submerged, causing a loss of consciousness. This was how Smith had murdered his wives.
Or, more accurately, this is how Smith might have murdered his wives. The state had no actual evidence that Smith had drowned his wives in this fashion, but at Smith's trial for murdering Bessie Mundy, the prosecutor would make an unprecedented argument. The evidence of the other two drownings should be admissible under a simple theory. What's the likelihood that the same man could have had three different wives drown without any bad faith on his part? And with that, the case that came to be known as the Brides in the Bath would capture the public's imagination. Here's more from Forensic Casebook.
George Joseph Smith was tried at the Old Bailey. The Brides in the Bath murders caused an absolute sensation, grabbing the headlines of every paper and knocking World War I off the front page. As huge crowds gathered outside the courtroom, the jury retired to consider their verdict. They took just 22 minutes to find George Smith guilty of murder. He was sentenced to death and hanged on the 13th of August, 1915.
The Brides in the Bath case would also birth the doctrine of chances, which is the principle that allows evidence of the same unusual thing recurring in a person's life to be admitted despite the absence of proof of the defendant's wrongdoing. This brings us back to Blackstone's formulation and the seeming inconsistency between it and the concept that someone can be convicted on what just might be bad luck.
Support for Undisclosed comes from our friends at Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/undisclosed. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org number 3030. A good illustration of the doctrine of chances can be found in the case of Frederick Martlin, which I started teaching back in 2009. Martlin lived in Michigan when his house burned down. Previous fires had damaged his home and his car, but the state had no evidence that Martlin had maliciously started any of these fires. The court, however, allowed evidence of these fires to be introduced under the doctrine of chances. Meanwhile, Martlin claimed that the circumstances of the current fire suggested there was an issue with an electrical outlet in the house, but he was indigent, and the court refused to appoint an electrical engineer to test this theory. Martlin was thereafter convicted of arson. Later, Martlin was represented by attorneys on appeal, including David Moran from the Michigan Innocence Clinic. They retained an electrical engineer, and he confirmed that yes, it was a problem with an outlet that started the fire. Martlin was set free in 2012. As Moran notes, the Martlin case is a good illustration of the potential problems with the doctrine of chances.
What percentage of the population will in their lifetime be a victim of an accidental fire? I'm sure it's less than 1%, but I'm guessing it's more than 0.1%. So let's just take a number, just a total guess. Let's say it's 0.2%. Let's say one out of every 500 people will in their life be in an accidental fire. Well, that means that if you just multiply 500 squared, which is 250,000, that one out of every 250,000 people will be in two accidental fires. And that, you know, that assumes that there's an independence of accidental fires, which there isn't. I mean, some people are going to be much more likely to be in accidental fires than other people. For example, people who are smokers are more likely to be in accidental fires than people who are not, people who live in large households, people who live with drug addicts.
North Carolina judges are well aware of these issues. As late as 1963, the Supreme Court of North Carolina held in a case Langlois versus State, the sufficiency of evidence in law to go to the jury does not depend upon the doctrine of chances. However confidently one in his own affairs may base his judgment on mere probability as to a past event, when he assumes the burden of establishing such event as a proposition of fact and as a basis for the judgment of a court, he must adduce evidence other than a majority of chances that the fact to be proved does exist. Parties would later cite Langlois for the proposition that evidence must be both consistent with guilt and inconsistent with innocence to be admissible. But by the time of its 1991 opinion in State versus Steger, the Supreme Court of North Carolina had repudiated its holding in Langlois. Now, according to the court, if the same unusual facts were present in the current crime and a past event, evidence that past event could be admitted under the doctrine of chances. Under the court's reasoning, while the past event might be consistent with guilt or innocence, quote, the fortuitous coincidence becomes too abnormal, bizarre, implausible, unusual, or objectively improbable to be believed.
The Steger case provides a classic example of the doctrine of chances. On February 1, 1988, Barbara Steger called the police after her husband had been fatally shot in their bed with a .25 caliber Beretta. Here's a clip from the Deadly Women TV episode on her case.
When first officers arrived on the scene, Barbara told them that she had removed a handgun from under Russ's pillow.
What's happened here, ma'am?
And that while she was removing it, it accidentally discharged.
It just went off. It was just accidental. And I've said to him...
The problem is, it's an accident she's had before.
And then so I got Russell's gun. Well, you know, he keeps it on the pillow, and I just dragged it.
With her first husband, Larry Ford.
And, you know, it went off.
When we learned about Larry Ford's death, that sent off a lot of signals, particularly when we learned that he was killed under similar circumstances. Same kind of weapon, at his house, happened in the middle of the night, just like Russ.
Of course, the deaths of Pamela Lanier's husbands were very different. Johnny Ray drowned and Doran died from arsenic poisoning. So what argument did the state make under the doctrine of chances? This takes us back to the archetype or the stereotype of the Black Widow. According to the state, Pam Lanier would marry men and kill them for their money. The state's argument sounded like the script for a TV show, and in this case, it actually became one. We just played a clip from the Deadly Women TV show. It's hosted by Candace DeLong, a former FBI criminal profiler, who some have called a real-life Clarice Starling, referencing the lead character in The Silence of the Lambs. Here's DeLong describing her show.
But in every show, we do three stories. They're all themed. For example, one episode might be women who kill their children, or another episode might be women who get their children to kill for them, or perhaps a story of three black widows, but all with different motivations. So that's pretty much what it's about.
The theme for the Blanche Taylor Moore episode was revenge. For Velma Barfield, it was Hearts of Stone. Barbara Steger's episode was called Fortune Hunters. In 2014, DeLong did a Deadly Women episode on the Pam Lanier case and two other cases. And that week's theme, quote, if looks could kill. Here's the episode description. Beauty is only skin deep. Scratch the surface and you could find an ugly soul. A gorgeous girl preys on an elderly man. A cabaret star performs a killer finale. And a farmer's wife harvests husbands. These deadly women get their way if looks could kill. The episode features a prosecutor and FBI agent who handled Pam's case, and the storyline is essentially what the state presented at trial. So let's go through the state's arguments and address them point by point.
Her first husband, Johnny, died in a farming accident 6 years earlier.
Johnny had been drinking all day,
and went out to check his crab pots. And walked out on a dock, stumbled in.
And that brings us to the prosecutor's argument while trying to admit this evidence at trial. Quote, what is the chance that she is the only one present every time one husband dies? The first husband drowns, and then Mr. Lanier, her second husband, dies of arsenic poisoning. Now, one thing might jump out to you from what we mentioned before. Pam wasn't alone with Johnny Ray when he drowned. Their son, Dustin, was out in the dock with his father. The other thing, though, you wouldn't know, and it's something the jury didn't know either, never heard. Johnny Ray wasn't Pam's first husband, or even her second.
And your first husband was Dennis Parker, who you knew from
yes,
high school?
Yes, me and him was high school sweethearts for a little while.
Okay. And so what age were you when you got married?
We were
Dennis?
Young, 18.
18 years old, okay.
Yes.
The marriage was too fast, too soon, and they were too young, and the marriage got annulled.
We were kids. Mm. I mean, basically, we were kids.
Okay.
I mean, I'm being honest, because he was nice. He was really a good guy. So I can't say anything negative about it.
Mm-hmm. And Pam's second husband was Mac Lammons, who was actually Dustin's biological father. That relationship started well, but Mac was a drinker, and when he would drink, he would get violent.
I got out of it because I didn't like being smacked every now and then. No reason I'm not gonna be smacked around. Right. Not when I didn't deserve it.
Right.
And assuming you think that the evidence of two of Pam's husbands dying is relevant, there seems to be a clear distinction between those being her only two husbands and those being two of her four husbands. But it's something the defense didn't mention at trial. Another thing that the prosecution did emphasize was the fact that both Dorian and Johnny Ray were in a confused state prior to their deaths. Again, here's a clip from the Deadly Women episode on Pam's case.
Her first husband, Johnny, died in a farming accident 6 years earlier.
Johnny had been drinking all day and went out to check his crab pots. And walked out on a dock, stumbled in.
It's a superficially compelling argument, but recall what we noted before. Johnny Ray saw the doctor the same day he drowned, and the doctor said his prior confusion had cleared up and that he merely had a blood pressure issue on the day he died. Therefore, Johnny Ray's prior confused state, which, as noted, was seemingly due to the flu, had nothing to do with his drowning, while Dorian's confused state was ostensibly caused by the same arsenic poisoning that led to his death. And, as noted, when Johnny Ray was exhumed, it was determined that he didn't have significant levels of arsenic in his system. Somehow, though, it was this fact, and not another fact, that got emphasized at trial. Here's another clip from the Deadly Women episode.
She told the police he was drunk and fell into the lake and drowned.
The police exhume Johnny Williams's body. And the tide turns.
There was no alcohol in his system.
As all the ladies know, when it comes to shopping for a bra, it is all about finding the right fit for you. And there's only one lingerie brand that offers bras in sizes from AA through G and half cup sizes. And that brand is Third Love. Third Love uses thousands of real women's measurements to create bras that fit better and feel great. Now, old school bra brands, you know, they only carry 15 sizes, and we come in many more than 15 sizes, believe me. And Third Love knows that. They have 60 sizes, including half cups. And honestly, I can't believe it's taken this long for someone to invent bras in half cup sizes. I mean, why wouldn't we need that? Beyond having one of the widest ranges of sizes, I think one of the most revolutionary things about Third Love is the way you get sized. And if anybody has been through the process, it is not comfortable. But with Third Love, all you have to do is take their Fit Finder quiz online. It just takes 60 seconds, and you can do it from the comfort of your home. You'll never have that awkward fitting room experience. So I love this Fit Finder. You take the quiz, and boom, you get the right size for you. Third Love knows there's a perfect bra for everybody, so right now they're offering my listeners 15% off your first order. I've got a couple of Third Love bras. They are beautiful. They fit comfortably. And as somebody who has struggled most of my adult life to get a good fit, it's about time. And if for some reason, which is highly unlikely, if you don't agree for some reason, returns and exchanges are completely free and easy. So go to thirdlove.com/undisclosed right now and find your perfect fitting bra and get 15% off your first purchase. That's thirdlove.com/undisclosed. thirdlove.com/undisclosed.
From the episode in the state's argument at trial, you'd think that the lack of alcohol in Johnny Ray's system was a surprising discovery after exhumation that cast doubt on Pam's story that he had been drinking on the day of his death. But that timeline is off. The toxicology screens were actually done in the days after Johnny Ray's death, and a report was completed on September 19, 1991, 2 weeks after Johnny drowned. It shows elevated levels of an antihistamine, which was consistent with Pam's claim that Johnny Ray was taking Benadryl. As we noted, Pam also said that Johnny was taking Ativan and Tenormin, which were prescribed to him earlier in the day, and the tox report notes the tox screens can't detect their presence. And finally, yes, the tox screen was negative for alcohol. But this wasn't at all surprising to Dr. Butts, the state's expert who performed the post-exhumation autopsy. Here's the pertinent Q&A at trial.
Question. Now, if the evidence should disclose the amount of alcohol we're referring to consumed by Johnny Williams at the time of his death was a third of a fifth, can you, to some degree of medical certainty, share with us your opinion regarding what you might expect to find at autopsy concerning alcohol?
A lot of my conditions that I described earlier would still apply. Depends on whether it was drunk at the beginning or end, but certainly with that quantity of alcohol, if it were drunk at the beginning of the period or were drunk at intervals and not all consumed toward the end, it's certainly possible there wouldn't be any alcohol in his system at the time of his death. Dr. Butts also noted that Johnny Ray was known to be a heavy drinker, and that this could mean that his liver would metabolize alcohol more quickly, making it even less likely that alcohol would be detected on his tox screens. So what about Dr. Butts' conclusion that Johnny Ray didn't have elevated levels of arsenic and that arsenic didn't contribute to his death? You might imagine the defense hammered this point home to the jury at trial. Instead, they didn't raise it at all. Why? When I talked to Pam, her sense was that the judge prevented them from introducing this evidence.
They couldn't bring up him being exhumed and I had signed that. They couldn't bring that up in the trial, and I couldn't understand that.
Right. So your sense was that they were trying
they should
to
have been
introduce
able,
it, but they weren't allowed to?
The state would not allow them to do it, is what I was under the impression. Mm-hmm.
But after reading the trial transcript, it turns out this wasn't the case. Instead, her attorneys actually asked the judge for the evidence connected to the exhumation not to be admitted. Why? Simply put, they didn't trust the jurors. You see, Johnny Ray did have some arsenic in his liver and hair, which is completely unsurprising. We all have some arsenic in our bodies. It's a naturally occurring metalloid that's in the food we eat, the water we drink, and even the air we breathe. And as Aaron Barkowski, a professor of environmental and occupational health, notes, those who eat a lot of seafood have higher levels of arsenic.
Seafood meal, there are organic arsenicals that are in seafood that are absolutely benign to humans and just kind of go straight through you, but it screws up the assay because unless they do the special assay to separate inorganic from organic, they can't tell whether that's benign compound or active inorganic.
This is significant because Johnny Ray worked at a tackle shop and was known to eat a lot of seafood, including the crabs he was trying to retrieve on the night that he died. Indeed, one witness at trial mistakenly thought that Johnny Ray had died while out in a fishing boat. So while Dr. Butts noted that Johnny Ray's arsenic levels were within the normal range and not the cause of his death, his levels were toward the upper end of that normal range. And so Pam's attorneys thought the jurors would ignore Dr. Butts' bottom line and focus on the arsenic levels to conclude that Pam could have been poisoning Johnny Ray. As a result, the jury never heard that Johnny Ray's arsenic levels were normal and not the cause of his death. Indeed, they never even heard that a post-exhumation autopsy was done, meaning that the issue of whether Johnny Ray was poisoned was a question mark rather than the dead end we know it to be.
The state also claimed a couple of other similarities that we think, or at least hope, the jurors saw as non-starters. First, the prosecutor claimed that when both Johnny Ray and Dorn were sick, Pam didn't seek medical attention for them until after being prompted by others. Now, we'll go into more detail about whether this is true for Dorn in a future episode, but what about Johnny Ray? The state's evidence related to Johnny Ray's hospitalization on August 20th. Jay Britt worked with Johnny Ray at the tackle shop, and he testified that on August 19th, between 6 and 6:30 a.m., Pam came to his house, loudly knocked on the door, and said that Johnny Ray was sick and that she wanted him to come and see about him. According to Jay, Johnny Ray seemed kind of out of sorts, but he was able to walk outside. Jay and Pam discussed taking Johnny Ray in for medical care, but nothing came of it. Then the following morning, Pam returned again between 6 and 6:30 a.m., and this time she knocked very loudly at the Britt residence, said that Johnny Ray was doing worse, and asked if he could help. This time, both Jay and his wife, Glendell, came. Pam says she thought Johnny Ray was in delirium tremens from alcohol withdrawal and tried to give him some alcohol. Jay said that he needed to see a doctor, and that's what was done. So, yeah, according to Jay, it was his idea for Johnny Ray to see a doctor, but it's not as if Pam was isolating her husband or doing nothing. She went over to the Britt residence 2 days in a row at the crack of dawn to get help for her husband, and that's what she got. And according to Pam herself, the state's claims were a complete mischaracterization of what had happened.
And so, when you go over to Jay Britt's house, what's your thinking in terms of Johnny Ray's
that he can go talk to him? Because they were really good friends, right. You know, he can go talk to him and maybe get him to let's go get some help.
Because you were trying to get Johnny Ray to go see the doctor and
he wouldn't go. And right. I knew that maybe he could talk to him.
And then there was the final similarity. There were life insurance policies on both Dorian and Johnny Ray, so Pam financially benefited from both their deaths. Well, that's what the state argued. Here's how Deadly Women put it.
Pamela inherits Johnny's farm and $25,000 in life insurance.
This is true, but it's hard to see how this distinguishes Pam's case from any number of cases in which spouses with life insurance policies pass away. But the prosecution tried to sweeten the pot by arguing that Pam had an incentive to kill Johnny Ray because they were in financial trouble and their trailer was being foreclosed on. This, however, ended up kind of blowing up in the prosecution's face. Their insurance agent, Wayne Anderson, was called at trial. And first, he testified that there was a $25,000 life insurance policy, but that it, quote, was strictly Johnny Williams' idea to take out the policy and not Pam's. Second, and more importantly, Anderson called Pam and told her that the policy was about to lapse, and she responded, quote, that money was tight and they simply couldn't pay premiums at the time. And so, a couple of weeks before Johnny Ray drowned, the life insurance policy lapsed. Or, at least that's what they thought. According to Pam, she was distraught after Johnny Ray's death and didn't know how she would make ends meet on her own with two young children. But then, she got a call from Anderson.
Wayne Anderson tells you what?
Wayne Anderson calls me and tells me he needs to talk to me. And I said, about what? Then he told me, he said, I need to talk to you. I said, but it's not been paid for. He said, you need to listen to me. I need to talk to you. And then he told me, basically, that he picked it up. Because he thought, well, you know, we're being at the beach, you know, and this, we were in a financial struggle, that he picked it up and he paid. I don't remember if he paid one, two, three. I don't even know how many he paid. But he said that it is paid. He said, you and the kids and Johnny still have life insurance. He said, because me and my wife picked it up.
Right.
At trial, Anderson would testify to the same thing. He was a new insurance agent who felt bad for Johnny Ray and Pam, and so he paid their premium out of his own pocket without telling them. When he called Pam to tell her what he had done, she said she was crying and sounded sincerely surprised.
So if it possibly wasn't any similarities between the deaths of Johnny Ray and Doran that turned the jury against Pam, what could be an alternate explanation? While there are disputes over the depth of the water in which Johnny Ray drowned, there was trial testimony that it was 3 to 4 feet deep, and Johnny Ray was known as a good swimmer. Here's one final clip from Deadly Women.
If Johnny wasn't drunk, how does a strong swimmer drown in shallow water?
That suggests to me that she was involved in the death of Johnny Williams.
Now, what this audio clip doesn't make clear is that the episode shows the actor pushing Johnny Ray into the water. And the voice you hear belongs to Blake Wallace, the SBI agent assigned to the case. But you can imagine jurors thinking the same thing, or really the same two things. First, why didn't Pam jump in to try to save him? When I shared a document with the narrative of the case, here was Rabia's response.
Okay, this is really shady. Why didn't either of them just walk into the water? It was so shallow. They just watched him drown in a few feet of water?
It's a natural response, and others have said something similar, even after I told them that Pam and her son Dustin both didn't know how to swim. And then there's the second thing that jurors might have been thinking. How does a good swimmer drown in only a few feet of water? This second point in particular gave me pause. So on both points, I decided to reach out to John Fleetmeyer, a drowning expert who has testified in a number of trials and is currently working with an Innocence Project on a case in Texas in which Kayla Day was convicted of drowning her husband. On the question of whether Pam should have jumped in the water to try to save Johnny Ray, here was his response.
Rule number one, never attempt to go in after a victim. It's better one drowning than two. So 100% they made the right decision. And we're actually doing a couple new videos through the National Drowning Prevention Alliance. And the last thing that we ever want someone to do, including police officers. And the other thing, as a sidebar, I was contracted for 2 years by the United States Border Patrol. All my educational information that I developed a training protocol, and that was to never allow even a Border Patrol agent, and certainly never a public citizen, even by virtue of the Good Samaritan Act, never allow them or never recommend them to go into the water. Even if they're a decent swimmer, they shouldn't, because they can be grabbed by the victim and they can be a victim themselves. That's just something that we highly recommend never to do.
Right, and so in this case where the wife and the son don't even know how to swim, that would be even worse for them to attempt.
Yeah, they would be gone. It would be a double drowning or triple drowning. There's a real good case that I'm involved in Lake Hag in Oregon, where a little boy was drowning, and the little boy's brother went in to save the little boy, the mother went in to save the little boy, the grandmother went in, and then the older brother, and five of them drowned.
And you and Dustin don't swim, right?
No.
And is that the thinking? Like, in other words, does the thought go through your mind at all to try to jump in and save him?
Or no, because I would have drowned it.
Right.
And so Dustin was a child. Mm-hmm. No, I wouldn't have done that.
Right.
There are also a few other important points to note. It was midnight, so it was dark, and the dock area wasn't especially well lit. And second, this was the Intracoastal Waterway. So these weren't still waters, and there was also a drop-off to 8 feet depth about where Johnny Ray fell in. Rudy Thompson, the man who retrieved Johnny Ray, was 5'8". He testified as follows.
It was about chest high because whenever I reached out, I was afraid I was going to step off any minute, so I just had to reach out and grab him.
When I talked to Thompson, he remembered these details.
Yeah, the drop-off was at the end of the pier. Yeah. In other words, right beside the dock is kind of shallow.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end, it drops off real quick.
And so he was pretty close to where it drops off then, from your recollection?
Whenever we spotted him, yeah.
This could also answer the question of how Johnny Ray drowned, because it's not hard to imagine him falling into the 8-foot water that was just a couple feet away from the water that was chest high on a man about his height. Not to mention, in these waterways, with the tides going in and out, the current can be swift and easily pull you off your feet. But let's say that the water was chest deep where Johnny Ray actually fell. Would him drowning in that depth of water be surprising? Again, here's John Fledemeyer.
In my early life, I taught police officers and first responders water rescue. And the first thing I tell them to do when they see someone drowning is to yell, "Hey, stupid, stand up." And I don't say stupid, but hey, stand up. Because approximately in open water environments, 40 to 50% of active drownings are in water that's not over a victim's head. So that information doesn't come as a surprise. I don't know how tall the victim was in our case, but typically in 4 feet of water, if a person 6 feet tall, if he's at a 45-degree angle, which wouldn't be uncommon, I could envision that being a drowning environment, and I could envision that happening.
So that's what happens with shallow water drownings. The victim freaks out, thrashes around, and just never gets vertical, never finds their feet. And this is consistent with what Pam described, that after Johnny Ray fell in, he thrashed around, bobbed up and down, and then disappeared into the water.
Then if this is an active drowning, typically there's a period of distress which occurs before the person goes underwater. water, a victim will begin to hyperventilate. And then that's, you have air, which you and I are breathing right now, which is the tidal volume, which is going in or out of our lungs. As our head becomes lower and lower in the water, as we hyperventilate, that air begins to escape. And as it escapes, we become negative buoyant. And as we become negative buoyant, we go underwater. At that point, sometimes a victim will bob up a few times, but eventually he or she will go underwater. And then at that point in time, they try to hold their breath as long as they possibly can. The literature shows it can be up to 80 seconds, but my research shows it's probably much shorter than that, maybe 40 seconds. And so you attempt to hold your breath as long as you possibly can. And when the urge becomes so great, you have another choice than to breathe. And when that happens, you breathe in water. And then you go into the actual physiology of drowning, where the body chemistry drastically changes. You stop breathing. The heart will continue to beat another couple minutes. And eventually that'll stop. And typically at 3 to 4 minutes, you go into what we call clinical death. And then and at 4 minutes, you still can be resuscitated. And then as the time progresses, you go into a stage called biological death, and that's when there's significant damage to the cells, especially the brain cells. And usually about 6 minutes after submergence, you can't be resuscitated, and you're biologically dead.
According to Fledemeyer, Johnny Ray falling unexpectedly into the water at around midnight also means that there was a decent chance that this is what is called a dry drowning.
There's a lot of situations where a surprise event would put you into the water where you would gasp, and there's a phenomenon or situation where the if water touches the larynx, it will spasm and shut, and that's called a dry drowning, and that's we think that happens in about 10% of cases, so that's something to consider.
And then, as Fledemeyer told Colin, there are risk factors associated with drowning, with a primary one being drug or alcohol use. And while there might be questions about whether Johnny Ray was drinking or how much, Benadryl was found in his system, and it seems reasonable to conclude that he took the Ativan and the Tenormin that he'd been prescribed earlier that day. Finally, we get to the fact that Johnny Ray was wearing clothes, including the white t-shirt that Rudy Thompson remembers floating to the surface. Fledemeyer talked to Colin about his testimony about the effects of clothing on drowning in a recent case.
I don't know if you have a pool. If you're near a pool, you'll be very surprised if you take a cotton t-shirt and throw it in the water, and the jury was surprised too. They think that, you know, throwing that in the water, it might take a minute or so for it to get saturated and sink to the bottom, but in actuality, in 5 to 10 seconds, it'll be on the bottom of the pool, and that's another thing that facilitates the drowning process because it becomes very negative buoyant and prevents a person from maintaining their body at the surface level. And the other very significant factor, and probably in this case, is whether or not the individual had shoes on.
So the clothes that Johnny Ray had been wearing increased his risk of drowning, and if he'd been wearing shoes at the time, that would have increased the risk even more. Rudy Thompson told Colin that he couldn't remember if Johnny Ray was wearing shoes at the time of his death, and Pam told me that she thought he was wearing shoes, but couldn't be certain about it. But the jury never heard from a drowning expert at trial, so we're left to just speculate about what conclusions they would have reached. But there's something we don't have to speculate about.
Over the last several months, I've been researching Doctrine of Chance's cases from North Carolina and around the country with A.C. Parham, who will be starting at South Carolina Law in the fall. And the conclusion we've been able to draw is that there's not any other case like Pam Lanier's case. The Doctrine of Chance has been used to admit evidence of multiple drownings, like in the Smith case. And it's been used to admit evidence of multiple shootings, like in the Steger case. And Pam's case itself set the foundation for the Michael Peterson case, in which a man was prosecuted for fatally pushing his wife down the stairs, and the state was allowed to admit evidence that Peterson was the last known person to see another woman who was later found dead at the bottom of a staircase years earlier.
1810 Cedar Street, please.
What's wrong?
My wife had an accident. She's still breathing.
What kind of accident?
Fell down the stairs. She's still breathing. Please come.
Is she conscious?
Attorneys at the same firm handled the appeals in both cases, and for reasons we'll discuss later, the Peterson case gives us the strongest reason to believe that Pam Lanier might one day be a free woman. The Peterson case, of course, is known for the Peabody Award-winning documentary, The Staircase.
This case is no more and no longer about Kathleen. Truth is lost in all of this now. Truth is of no meaning whatsoever.
On the other hand, Pam's case is primarily known from her episode of Deadly Women.
Her first husband, Johnny, died in a farming accident 6 years earlier.
Months before that episode aired, Pam received a letter from Candace DeLong saying she wanted to interview her. The letter notes how her coverage of past cases has led to, quote, renewed legal interest in their cases and a positive response from the general public. In the letter, she notes, quote, I have no interest in blindsiding you or creating a sensationalist story for the masses.
So if I take you to 2014, I know this is a touchy subject. You brought it up a little bit before, but you get a letter from Candace DeLong.
Oh.
She says she wants to feature you in a program. And
She already did.
Right. What's your thought when you get that letter?
When I got that letter, I was called about it. And one of the white shirts, I think it was a lieutenant, she called me and she told me that we have, the studio is wanting to do an interview with you. I said, on what? And then she told me, I said, I can't make no decisions without calling home. And I said, you know, I'm not going to do this without talking to somebody. She said, well, you need to make a decision soon and let me know. Well, I went back to work and I didn't get a chance to call nobody. But I did do this. My supervisor, she was my age, just 2 weeks difference in her age. And I said, can I talk to you, Ms. Smith, about something? And I told her. And I said, I don't feel good about it. There's something telling me not to do it. She said, don't do it. She says, if you've got that feeling, don't do it. So I went back and I told him to send it that I wasn't going to do it. And I guess that didn't do no good.
Yeah. And you haven't seen the actual program yourself.
No, but I've heard about it.
Right.
I've heard it's something. I've been waiting for it to pop up here on television, so I'll have to fight my way the rest of the time.
The Pam Lanier Deadly Women episode has been uploaded to YouTube, and it currently has 265 comments. You can imagine their tone. Absolute monster. She is evil. She should get the chair. Some women are thirsty for the money they kill to get it. And Black Widow. It's been interesting because it's made many people gun-shy about talking with us about the case, including Pam Hatcher, who submitted the case to the Wake Forest Innocence Project, which is currently handling the appeal.
Pam even was a little weary.
Oh, probably
I think.
Because of that documentary, the so-called
Everybody
documentary.
Everybody has seen, yes.
I refuse to watch it. It's...
Thank you, because they say it can get kind of rough.
Pretty rough indeed. As we finish recording the episode, here's what Rabia noted.
I saw the episode. It was awful. And actually, to be honest, when I think about this case, I can't get those images out of my head. So, it's hard for me to, like, that's become the story.
A big part of what I wanted to do in this series was to pull back the veneer of the Black Widow created by the prosecution at trial and society in general when they hear that a husband has died from something other than natural causes. It was also to give Pam a chance to reclaim her story and share it with the world. So who is Pam Lanier, and what was her relationship with Doran? Next time on Undisclosed.
A big thank you to everybody who makes Undisclosed possible and has made this series possible. Thank you to our sponsors who help us put on our episodes week after week. Thank you to Mital Dalhan, our executive producer, for helping keep this ship afloat. Thank you to Rebecca Lavoie, our fantastic audio producer, and also the co-host and producer of a couple of my favorite podcasts, including Crime Writers On. Do not miss her podcast. Thank you to Baluki for our logo, to Christy for maintaining our website. A big thank you to AC Parham for helping with research on the Pam Lanier series. And also, Rebecca Lavoie will be hosting our addendum, so I'm pretty excited about that. Make sure to tag Rebecca in your questions, anything related to this case. Use the hashtag UDAddendum, and Rebecca Lavoie's Twitter handle is @REBLavoie, L-A-V-O-I-E. Also, a big thank you to our listeners. Thanks for coming back week after week. Check us out and make sure to follow us online on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Our handle is @UndisclosedPod. And please do not forget to subscribe to us on iTunes and rate us. Thanks so much. See you in a week.